Hi everyone. I'm just going to take a minute before starting our episode to thank everyone that's been listening. We've actually surpassed 50,000 downloads, which is just amazing. Thank you for your continued support and suggestions, as well as all the positive and kind words. Next week, I'll be taking the week off from our regular releases to work on another episode. There'll be a short episode coming out, so I'll be hosting it solo, and it's just some added information on a past case that we've already discussed. If you need some extra content while we're away, you can find us on Patreon under Crime and Mystery Canada, and we'll be back the following week with our regular content. So I hope everyone enjoys today's episode. Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome back. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Michelle.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On today's episode, we're going to be covering two cases of murdered women. There's unfortunately not a lot of information about either one of these cases, but they're both still unsolved. The first case we're going to talk about tonight is the murder of Jessica Estabrooks. Jessica was 20 years old when she went missing. She was from a very small place called Dorchester in the province of New Brunswick. The current population there is just over 1,000 people. She and her fiancé, who she'd met in high school according to a 1996 Times and Transcript article, they'd just moved to Moncton. They'd found some jobs. They were working to build a future together. Jessica and Shane, her fiancé, had gotten engaged the previous Christmas, and they were living together in an apartment on Waverly Avenue in Moncton. Moncton, New Brunswick is not a big city by any stretch of the imagination, so we grew up really close to there, and we lived there for a number of years as well.
Right.
But having, both of us also grew up in a really small place where you literally know everyone, if not by name, you know them by sight. So I can see, coming from a really small place, how Moncton might feel daunting to Jessica. And her family did state in a Times and Transcript article that she did feel sometimes a little bit overwhelmed and intimidated by the city. She was usually more comfortable traveling around the city when she was with Shane.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've met people before, actually, who are from the outskirts. Granted, they were a little bit older than what she would have been, but they grew up in the country, and then they were scared to do anything in the city alone, even though it's small.
Yeah, it can be a big change for some people, especially if you haven't really spent any time there.
And there's a lot of unknown, like taking the bus, for example, or like you're running to different kinds of people that might seem strange.
For sure. So on the evening of August 23rd in 1996, Jessica finished her shift at the local Burger King on Mountain Road. On her walk home, she stopped by Domino's Pizza to have a chat with her fiancé, who worked there, and then she was supposed to head home. As far as it could be pieced together, it seems like she did make it home. Her uniform was found in her apartment, and it looked like she'd fixed herself a snack that she'd started to eat, but it was only partially eaten. It's believed that she left the apartment shortly after getting there. Her family believes that she actually started watching a few minutes of a movie before she was either interrupted or decided to leave, because they found the movie backdraft in the VCR, and she was only a few minutes into the film. I'm assuming they knew her plans were to watch a movie, and they could tell, obviously, from where the tape was that she was only a few minutes in. The fact that she'd fixed herself something to eat and hadn't eaten it entirely kind of showed that she was in and out pretty quickly.
Right. Was there any signs that somebody else was in there?
No. So her boyfriend found that only one of the locks on the door was engaged when he got home. And usually if they left for any length of time, so there were two locks, they would lock both of them. But if they were only out for a few minutes, they would only lock one of them. So when he got home, he only found one of them locked. There wasn't any mess or anything out of place in the apartment. Jessica was gone, her purse was also gone, and there was just no sign of her. And this was a day before cell phones, so especially if you were like a young couple in your first apartment, just working your first jobs, you wouldn't have afforded a cell phone in 1996. They were pretty rare.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's not a lot of information about Jessica out there and what happened on the night she went missing. On some of the snippets of articles that I did find, some stated that she was last seen on Killam Drive, which means that she was last seen when she was headed home after stopping at Domino's Pizza. But another article said that she was seen leaving her apartment around 8 p.m. So I can't really say what the last confirmed sighting of her would have been, but it does look like she left the apartment shortly after getting there, which would have put her around 8 p.m.
Kind of have to wonder if somebody might have called her and made up some emergency or something.
Right, it could have been a call. But I think, and we'll get into that a little bit after, but her family thinks somebody showed up. Like someone she knew showed up at the door and she left, like thinking she was only going out for a few minutes.
Okay.
So there was no sign of Jessica anywhere and she hadn't been in touch with her family. For weeks, her family and the police searched for her. The police did speculate that she may have left voluntarily, but her parents said there's no way that that would have happened. She didn't have a passport, and they said she just wouldn't do something like that. The police wouldn't say whether or not her bank account had been touched since she left. Weeks went by with no news. Then partial remains were discovered near the Petitcodiac River in Beaumont, New Brunswick, on October 21st, 1996. So this was about 2 months after she went missing. Specifically, it was a skull that was discovered, and it was determined to be Jessica's.
Wow, so that's kind of weird because like Beaumont is like either Dorchester or Memramcook, which is very close to where she grew up, if it's not actually in Dorchester.
So I had this a little bit later, but we can talk about that now. I do find it a little odd that she went missing in Moncton and her remains were found basically where she was from.
Yeah, that is strange.
So, Beaumont, like if you're driving from Beaumont to Dorchester, like you have to go around the Memramcook River, so it's actually a little bit of a spin.
Yep.
But as the crow flies, it's just right there. Like it's just around the corner, essentially.
Yeah, it's very close. It's like basically the same area.
So I did look it up because the Petitcodiac River does flow through or past Moncton. It is accessible in the city of Moncton, but not, it would be like an hour walk from her apartment to get access to the river.
Right.
And unless she got in a vehicle with someone, she was on foot. But the Petitcodiac River also flows in the direction of Dorchester Beaumont. So, like, if something had happened in Moncton, that's the direction things would have flowed.
I was wondering that actually.
But that being said, I don't know if her remains were found near the river, as in, like, it was just close by, or they may have been deposited there by the river. I couldn't find the information on, like, how close that was found and what the chances were that that was actually brought down by the river. So I really don't know, but I did think that was a little bit odd that those remains were discovered so close to where she was originally from.
And I'm kind of wondering too, like, you know how it's the world famous tide. So I don't know if that means that it would help or be good for dragging something or someone very far, or if it would make it impossible to deposit anything on the side in a way, like that it would drag it past in the water instead of being able to come up to the side, if that
Yeah,
makes sense.
I know what you're saying, but I really don't know the answer to that. I'm assuming it was kind of looked into, but there's not a ton of information at all about this case, really.
I've never heard of it, and like I know many people that live there and that would have been from there at that time.
Yeah, I knew of it because it had been mentioned to me before, and I've actually thought of covering this case several times, but every time I looked into it, I just didn't have enough to make a full episode out of it. So that's why we're talking about two separate cases today, because both of those don't have a lot of information. So they determined that the skull was Jessica's, and they also determined through a forensic autopsy that she had met with foul play. It doesn't specify what was found, it just says that they believe she met with foul play. According to a November 15, 1996 Times and Transcript article, the case was handed over from the local police to the RCMP. The area was searched for further clues, but they didn't find anything.
Is there any mention that they might be suspecting the boyfriend?
I didn't find any of that in the articles. I did see some chatter online about different things, but there's nothing to back that up when it comes to potential suspects or persons of interest. So there's really no mention through the articles or from the police that they had any suspicions about him.
Okay.
The same article states that the police had made an arrest in September, but that the suspect had been released the next day and no charges had been laid. I couldn't find a reason why they didn't lay any charges. It's a little bit odd to me that they actually arrested someone and then let them go the next day, because usually you'd think they would just bring them in for questioning or something like that. So I don't know what happened there. I have no idea who this person was. I mean, I'm sure at the time it was known locally, because I think it would be hard to keep that a secret, but I couldn't determine who it was through the information that's out on the internet. Jessica's family says that because there was no sign of a struggle, that she'd taken her purse with her, and even the lights in the apartment were all turned off when her boyfriend came home, it was likely, and I already mentioned this, but it was likely that someone that she knew came to the door, that she wasn't forced out or rushed out of the apartment.
So we're thinking possibly a friend of hers could have shown up and they went somewhere and then she met with foul play.
It could be, but that's just a theory. She may have very well left alone as well. Like, we don't know any of this for a fact. Like you said, it could have been a phone call, but I would like to think that they could have checked the phone records even in 96.
I would say that they could. I feel like there was, you could see who was calling at that time.
If you had caller ID, which I don't think was super popular, but you could star 69 to get like the last number that called your house.
Right.
But I'm sure if you went to the phone company, you'd be able to get those records as well, right?
I would think so. I mean, this is based on me knowing nothing, but...
Yeah. It's based on us being alive in 1996, basically.
Yeah, pretty much it.
Unfortunately, other than knowing that Jessica went missing in 1996 and that her partial remains were found, we don't know anything else. Her body was never found. No, as far as we can tell, there's no further evidence of anything. They didn't release the cause of death, or at least not that I could find. I mean, if I could have actual access to newspaper archives, I might be able to get more information, but the border's closed right now, so I can't get to a New Brunswick library. So other than that, there's a brief CBC article from 2000 that just kind of reiterates that she went missing, partial remains were found, and the case is still open. But there's nothing else out there. And I mean, we do talk about cold cases on this podcast, but it feels like this one is really cold. There's really nothing there.
There's not much of a clue to go on.
Right. And Jessica was described by her family as a little bit of a homebody who generally wouldn't like to be away from her family for any great length of time. They really don't believe, I think, that she left her house of her own accord, that she just left to, you know, go run an errand or something like that. I think the family strongly feels that she was with someone when she left the house. And I didn't know Jessica, like, we grew up in the same area that she did, and I had a house just a few blocks from where her apartment would have been. This was years later, but it really, like, when I was looking up this case, it really hit me how that happened somewhere where we were all the time.
Yeah. If it was close to your house that you used to have,
yeah,
it is known, well, some of the streets there are known to be a little more rough than others.
If you have any information on Jessica Estabrook's murder, you can contact the RCMP at 506-452-3491 or Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. The next case we're going to talk about today is going to be the case of Rachel Russell. This case was suggested by a listener who knew Rachel. Rachel's case is part of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls cases. According to a 2017 Northumberland News article by Karen Longwell, Rachel was a dog groomer who worked for the Humane Society. She was living in Cobourg, Ontario. During her life, she'd met with some obstacles. In her mid-20s, she'd been complaining about abdomen pain, and then when her appendix burst, which is pretty serious, she had to have surgery, and they actually discovered that she had cancerous cells in her abdomen.
Oh, wow.
So the type of cancer she had was usually something that would happen in seniors, not in someone in their mid-20s. She needed to have surgery for it, and I think they took out like part of her intestine or something along those lines. The conclusion of this is that the recovery was a really hard go. She was in a lot of pain, and she ended up becoming addicted to painkillers. According to her sisters, she did try to get help. She went to rehab, but it was complicated by the fact that she was in pain and did need help controlling that pain. I think one of the things to remember here is no one wants to be an addict. Often life circumstances will happen in a way that we don't really have any control over. And just because a person has a drug addiction, it doesn't make them a bad person. They don't deserve to die. They don't deserve to meet a violent end. And ultimately, this is what happened to Rachel.
Well, it's actually kind of a common occurrence, too, that somebody hurts their back badly or their neck or something, and they get this kind of painkiller, and then they're hooked.
Right.
And then what do you do? It's not a secret how hard it is for people to come off those things.
And, I mean, they're addictive, right? That's the thing, too. Like, a lot of the treatments we have for pain are addictive, so it's... it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, people don't want to live in constant pain. They need pain management. But sometimes the outcome of that is that you end up with an addiction.
It's pretty scary, really.
It is, yeah. At the time of her death, Rachel had a four-year-old son that her family members were helping to take care of. From what I could find, Rachel never officially was reported as missing. When her remains were discovered, they were discovered along a train track in Cobourg, Ontario, and that was on November 12th, 2007. There was a passerby looking for empty beer bottles just to collect in return for the deposit, and he's the one who found her remains. It's believed that Rachel was actually killed sometime in October, so probably at least 2 weeks before she was discovered. And that her body had just remained there until he stumbled upon it. The area where she was found was known to be frequented by drug users and drug dealers, according to the site Justice for Native Women. She's believed to have died from blunt force trauma.
So is there any idea, or does anyone have any insight on whether she would have been in that area because she might have been using something else, or maybe she was brought down there?
I think I read somewhere that they think that the murder occurred somewhere else, but I didn't put that in my notes here because I don't think it was a news article. I think it was someone commenting on a news article, so I'm not sure if there's any basis to that.
Okay.
When she was found, like at the time before she was found, she had been going sort of missing on her family for several days at a time. So it wasn't unusual for her to go out and the family not to hear from her for a while. So that's why I was saying, I don't think she was ever officially reported missing because the family was kind of used to her going out and not hearing from her.
Right.
Two of Rachel's sisters are still conducting fundraisers to help raise awareness and keep Rachel in people's minds. There was an arrest made back in 2008 for Rachel's murder, but ultimately there was not enough evidence to prosecute the man and he was let go. According to a 2009 Northumberland News article, the charges were withdrawn in May of 2009. They didn't believe there was enough to reasonably think that they were able to convict him, so I think there just lacked evidence. Apparently this man was known to Rachel.
Hmm.
Rachel's family said that she really hung around all sorts of people, some that were really well off, some that would have been really poor. Her family says that her death could be attributed to a variety of things. It could have had to do with her drug habit, but she was also a very opinionated person, and they also think that she may have gotten into an argument with someone that turned violent.
I suppose if you're on some sort of drug too, it could make you a little more confrontational.
Right. I won't go into details about the man that was arrested for her murder. Ultimately, and I think this is according to the site Justice for Native Women, he was cleared, and he has since passed away. Regardless of what happened, her family deserves answers and Rachel deserves justice. According to the Northumberland OPP, the case does remain open and there is a reward for information that would lead to solving this case. If you have any information, you can call 1-888-310-1122. The police are open to any kind of tip people may have, including information on Rachel's whereabouts and activities in the days leading up to her death. And the thing is, it's kind of like we were discussing with the Edmonton, the women that were being murdered from downtown Edmonton. In that case, it was women who were sex workers. In this case, we're talking about someone who had a drug addiction. If she was hanging out with other addicts, it's hard for them to go to the police because oftentimes they might have a record. They might be afraid to say something that would incriminate them in something else.
Or they might fear whoever did it.
They might be scared of whoever did it. So them coming forward might be difficult, but this happened back in 2007. So a lot of years have passed. People might be in different circumstances now where they feel more comfortable coming forward. And that's the thing in these cases. I mean, I can't speak for all police departments, but generally they're not looking to get people into trouble for sort of associated illegal activity that they might have done, but they just really want answers about what happened to Rachel. Anything you'd want to add for either one of these cases?
Well, I guess like everybody else, I don't have any ideas of what could have happened, but it's just like the regular, I just always feel bad for the families that don't really have any answers. Like I would just have so many questions if it was my loved one that went missing. So it's just, I always kind of keep in mind the families that have been suffering and kind of hope that at some point they can find some answers.
Right. And I think both these cases, it's women that were there 1 minute and were gone the next. And we have just so many gaps in between that we can't fill. We're going to be finishing up tonight with a moment of kindness. I just recently celebrated my birthday, so it's the second birthday that was celebrated in COVID times. And it really seems like anytime a holiday comes around and you can't get together with family like you normally would, it kind of hits home a lot harder.
Definitely.
But this year, everyone reached out in any way they could. So a text message, a line on Facebook, a video chat. It really helped to make the day better that people reached out that way. I know I couldn't see everyone, but that was great. I think reaching out just to let people know you're thinking about them is a way to make people feel a little bit better in these times. I know it really worked for me, and I really appreciate everyone just taking a few minutes out of their day.
That's good. I'm glad you had a good day.
I did. Thanks again to everyone who's been listening. I really appreciate people reaching out with episode suggestions as well. There are some cases that I never would have come across without your help, and I'm doing my best to get to all of them. If you're looking for some extra content, you can find us on Patreon. Our next full-length Patreon episode will be out on April 7th, so just search for Crime and Mystery Canada. You can find us on Instagram or Facebook under Crime and Mystery Canada, and you can reach out and write us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. Stay safe out there and have a good night.
Have a good night.